Good, so welcome back everybody, and welcome if you've just arrived. So, before I launch in, thanks Gus, just to say that this series of talks that Suri Gupta and I are going to be giving, so far we've just had one, that was last week, that was me. They're all being recorded, thank you Gus. They're all being recorded and you can catch up on them. And the idea is that we are going to look at themes that to do with our Sevenfold Puja. Last week, I wasn't explicitly referring to the Sevenfold Puja, but I talked about the need for reverence and the need to look up and this sort of innate need that we have for value, for something more. And I talked about puja as a way of cultivating receptivity to what is of value, to something more than us, but it's also a way of opening up to the influence of the Dharma as embodied in the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and allowing that influence to transform us. And I went into a little bit about Buddhist notions about the nature of reality, or at least why reality isn't as it appears to be. So today I want to continue from that theme, and I want to sort of pick up where I left off and move to looking at the next verses of the puja, or at least the themes that arise from that. So what I want to do is particularly emphasize that it's not enough to have this reverence, this devotion, this sense of even this sense of worship, that alone is probably not enough. I say probably because you might be one of those rare individuals for whom devotion and reverence is such a strong faculty in you, such a strong response that it sort of is enough. But for most of us, it's not enough. It's not enough. We can easily, I don't know about easily, but we can experience inspiration. We can experience this sense of there being something more to the universe, more to us, more to our potential, something beautiful, something worthwhile, something meaningful. Sometimes it's not possible to put it into conceptual terms, and yet it's very, very tangible as an experience. When you experience a sense of meaning and value in the way that I'm talking about, particularly if it's touched with or tinged with the transcendental, the way things really are, you definitely know. It's not something that you then have to wonder about. You definitely know, so it's tangible, and yet it seeds our capacity to conceptualize, to put it into words. Of course, many people try, and you could say that the whole of theistic religion is people putting it into words and putting the concept God onto this experience, this transcendent experience. And Buddhism doesn't do that. Buddhism says if you put that label on it, it can easily lead you into error. The error is, well, it's got a sort of philosophical basis, in that Buddhism is saying that this value, this meaning, this ultimate potential, this nature of how things really are, we're part of that. You can't sort of say it's outside of us. On the other hand, you can't say that it's just within us. It's everything, and we're part of everything. And inside and outside, when you really look at it, don't really make sense. Separateness doesn't really make sense. So God, particularly if it's taken wrongly, becomes a concept which is the biggest being outside of us. That's not putting it very well, I know, but that's pretty crude. And I know that not all theistic practitioners would have, they may have a much more sophisticated notion of God, but if they do have a more sophisticated notion of God, if it's a more mystical notion, where God isn't really outside, or you can't really say God's within. If it's a more mystical notion, then probably the word God doesn't help. Yeah, you're better off trying to find other words. So Buddhism's very, very keen on not pinning down in conceptual terms what the ultimate meaning is. It's saying that if you pin it down in conceptual terms, not only are you reducing it, you're falsifying it. And that falsification can lead to all sorts of dangerous things. So when I'm talking about worship, I don't mean in the theistic sense. And if you say to me, what are you worshipping? You'd have to listen to my whole talk last week, and even that probably won't explain it. It's much more mysterious than that. It's much more unconceptualizable. And yet Buddhism says we do need to have a tangible sense of the goal. It's no good just saying, oh, it's all mysterious and therefore we won't think about it. One way of, one safer way, well, truer way of approaching the mystery of what consciousness is, what life is to use our imagination. And by imagination, particularly the way Sangharakshita, my teacher and the founder of this order and movement, the way he talks about imagination is in the way that the Romantic poets talked about it, in the way that Coleridge talked about it, not just as fantasy, not just as something that you do with your doodling pad or something. It's not that. It's a higher faculty that unites reason and emotion and volition in a synthesis that transcends all of those. It's the whole of us at our best, responding to something higher. That's what he calls imagination. That's what Coleridge meant by imagination. He took the word imagination and gave it a capital letter. It's imagination with a capital I. And unfortunately, we don't tend to use that word in that way anymore. The word has got debased. So imagination can be equated with fantasy and therefore falsehood. Whereas actually the faculty of imagination in this higher exalted sense is the faculty that leads to truth, to real meaning. And so you could say that the puja is about developing that faculty. And the personifications of the enlightened mind, enlightened qualities like compassion, like wisdom, like energy, like fearlessness, like love, they're personified because they're easier to imagine in personified form. So that's why we have the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas looking as they do. They're beautiful beings that we're meant to visualize and imagine becoming, actually. Imagine that we're uniting with them. We can be blessed by them, but in the end, we can become Buddhas. We can become Bodhisattvas. We can become, which is again different from a theistic tradition, unless you take it in a very mystical sense. A traditional theist wouldn't say that you can become God. Probably that would be heretical in at least a traditional kind of theistic sense. But Buddhism's saying, no, the Buddha and the Bodhisattvas, they represent our own potential. We're trying to become these beings. Now, of course, we won't literally become them, but our minds will inhabit the world that they represent. And to depict that, people have had visions, I guess, and these visions have come down to us and become part of an imaginative lineage. And Manjudosha is, in a way, one of the first, possibly the first bodhisattva to appear in the Buddhist tradition. He's a being, he's made of light, as are all the Buddhas and bodhisattvas, the archetypal Buddhas and bodhisattvas that we imagine, that we visualize. He's a being of light. He's associated particularly with the sun. the sun as the source of ultimate life, the ultimate source, I mean, of life, but also the sun as something, well, the sun starts to represent the transcendental. He's associated with the sun. He's the colour of the sun at sunrise. Sometimes at sunrise, the sun is a sort of amber, amber-golden colour. I watched some sunrises on my long retreat, where I was, you could see the sun rising from the sea, and it would take about an hour to, you know, you get this false dawn, don't you? It's called a false dawn. Actually, it's not false in any sense. It's just beautiful. Yet the sky just turning one shade of purple or red or orange or gold after another, and these vivid, vivid blues appearing out of the darkness, and then finally, after about an hour, this first of all, this tiny but brilliant sort of dot of light with a huge sort of aura of rays would start to surface, of course reflected in the water, and then of course this orb, this shining orb would rise. And the first time I saw it rise like that, I mean, one of the shocking things, I mean, I was easily shocked on retreat, was that this happened every day. This happened every day because it was such an intense drama. It was such a kind of cosmic, I was witnessing one of the most beautiful cosmic events imaginable. And it happened every day. And actually most days I couldn't be bothered to get up in time for it. But there you go. So anyway, Mandragosha is particularly associated with the sun. He's the colour of the sun as it rises. And he holds, in his right hand, he holds this sword, which is a flaming sword of wisdom. It's not aggressive, although it is active. With the sword, he cuts through delusion. It's said that our delusions are like a veil that keep us from seeing things as they are. And there are two veils. One is all our self-centered, egotistical emotion, all our clinging, and all the emotions that come from that, our craving, our selfishness, our hatred, our fear, our resentment, our sense of being hard done by. All of that keeps us from seeing things as they are. That constitutes one veil that keeps our minds contracted and dark. And the other veil that he just cuts through, burns through, is the veil of wrong views. Because views, our views are vital, vitally important for either sending us on the wrong track or orientating us towards the truth. So for example, the Buddha said that belief in a creator God is a wrong view. And it doesn't seem particularly harmful until it goes wrong, you know, and then it can go very wrong, can't it? A belief in a creator God. And he was saying it's a wrong view. It keeps you from seeing things as they really are. There are lots of wrong views. Anyway, that was the one that comes to mind. So he has this sword that just cuts through these veils of delusion. And then, of course, in his left hand, in this particular form, the form that's on the shrine, he's not holding the book. There's a book, but he's not holding, in this form, he's holding a lotus flower. And the book is resting on the lotus flower. But in another form, he holds the book to his heart. And the book isn't any old book like this book. Actually, this isn't any old book either. It's the book. It's the principle of the book. The book. With a capital T and a capital B. And it's the book of the perfection of wisdom. So, you know, as a child, you might have read The Sword in the Stone is The Sword in the Stone the right thing? Anyway, something. But you get the sense of a book that opens up to the truth, you know, and it might be full of magic spells. Well, the book is the perfection of wisdom, and the perfection of wisdom in Buddhism is a tradition where it's sutras that go right to the heart of the enlightened experience. They come as close to saying what the nature of reality is as can be said, but they tend to say it in a paradoxical or negative form. They tend to say it's not this, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this, and you're meant to be left with this gap, this opening that within which you can realize the truth for yourself, but it won't be conceptualized. So the perfection of wisdom text, like the Heart Sutra, is a perfection of wisdom text. Demolish conceptual understanding. They demolish it ruthlessly. Even Buddhist concepts, even all Buddhist teachings are demolished by the conceptual, the perfection of wisdom. It's fantastic. And he holds this. He holds this book to his heart. So he's a personification of that ultimate wisdom that is, of course, our own potential, that is our true nature, you could say. And the wonderful thing is, I've been meditating on the figure of Manjugosha for a number of years, and the wonderful thing is that wisdom isn't a dry, cold, cool affair. In fact, wisdom's not a great word for wisdom. I guess the word in Buddhism is pranya, or jnana. And the quality of Manjugosha's wisdom, or of the perfection of wisdom, or of enlightened wisdom, is love. It's metta. The emotional quality is metta. There's a sort of knowing quality as well. There's a, for want of a better word, a sort of knowing quality, a cognitive quality. But the emotional quality is love, is metta. But what I was saying earlier is that reverence and worship alone are not enough, because Buddhism isn't just about devotion, it's about transformation. It's about transformation. That's the key. It's not enough to visualize Manjugosha or chant or do puja or supplicate, you know, make offerings to the Buddha or prostrate. All of that's necessary, but it's only a means to an end. It's only useful to the extent that it transforms our minds and transforms our lives. The whole point is that we change, we grow, we become more than we are. And as Maitra Bandhu was saying in the tea break, the potential of the mind is far, far greater than most of us probably most of the time realize or even imagine. He uses this analogy, you've probably heard it, I'll repeat it briefly. If you were an acorn, which you're not, but if you were, and you were told about realizing your true potential, you might think that that meant becoming a bigger acorn. Yeah, a really shiny, golden, bigger, huge acorn. Yeah? An acorn could never imagine, probably, well, definitely, its true potential would be something completely transformative, something of a different order, and yet it's contained somehow in that tiny, tiny seed. Or nut, or whatever it is, I don't know what it is. Similarly, that's an analogy for we really can't, most of the time, imagine what the enlightened mind is. It's of a different order. It's not just us on a good day. It's not just good at our, it's not just us at our happiest and most kind and loving. And it's of a different order. And yet, it's our potential. That's what's so exciting. An imaginative visual description is one way of connecting with that potential. Yeah? Imagine being a being of light, a goddess, a green goddess, Tara, or a golden figure, representing the sun, wielding this sword of wisdom and holding his book. Imagine that. And it's not fantasy. It's imagination, which reaches the truth. Just as poetry can say things that prose can't. Poetry can say something truer than prose, often. And I want to read you something which is a favourite little passage of mine from David Foster Wallace. Many of you may have heard me read it before. David Foster Wallace was a writer, a novelist, and this passage that I'm going to read is from an address that he gave to some students in Kenyon College graduating in 2005, and it's, I don't know, in American universities they have these commencement speeches. I guess they're saying that life is commencing for these young people. Yeah, it's quite a good tradition. And he gave this speech, which has become celebrated, and it's I think it's fabulous. And I'm just going to read you a few paragraphs from it. Unfortunately, David Foster Wallace died tragically. He suffered from depression all his life, and in the end, he committed suicide. That's tragic in anybody. It's tragic, I guess. But particularly, you'll see the poignancy of this, because in this speech, he's pointing to our potential, and he must have been in touch with that potential, as well as with the depths of darkness and despair that finally seemed to overwhelm him. Anyway, he talks about worship, and then he talks about transformation, transforming our lives. Because here's something else that's true. In the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is actually no such thing as atheism. There is no such thing as not worshipping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And the compelling reason for maybe choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship, be it Jesus Christ or Allah or Yahweh or the Wiccan Mother Goddess or the Four Noble Truths, or some inviolable set of ethical principles, is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough. Never feel you have enough. It's the truth. Worship your body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. On one level, we all know this stuff already. It's been codified as myths, proverbs, cliches, epigrams, parables, the skeleton of every great story. The whole trick is keeping the truth up front in daily consciousness. Worship power, you will end up feeling weak and afraid, and you will need ever more power over others to numb you to your own fear. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. But the insidious thing about these forms of worship is not that they're evil or sinful, it's that they're unconscious. They're the default settings. They're the kind of worship you gradually slip into day after day, getting more and more selective about what you see and how you measure value, without ever being fully aware that that's what you're doing. And the so-called real world will not discourage you from operating on your default settings. Because the so-called real world of men and money and power hums merrily along in a pool of fear and anger and frustration and craving and worship of self. Our own present culture has harnessed these forces in ways that have yielded extraordinary wealth and comfort and personal freedom. The freedom all to be lords of our own tiny, skull-sized kingdoms, alone at the centre of all creation. This kind of freedom has much to recommend it, but of course there are different kinds of freedom. And the kind that is most precious, you will not hear much talk about in the great outside world of wanting and achieving. The really important kind of freedom involves attention and awareness and discipline and being able truly to care about other people and to sacrifice for them over and over in a myriad petty, unsexy ways every day. That is real freedom. That is being educated and understanding how to think. The alternative is unconsciousness, the default setting, the rat race, the constant gnawing sense of having had and lost some infinite thing. Isn't that just brilliant? Isn't that just wonderful? It's so poignant every time I read it, and I think of him obviously feeling that and getting lost. And I wonder how he would have been had he learnt to meditate. Maybe he did, I don't know. I don't really know much about his life. But I think that what's wonderful about Buddhism is that it in its own language, well, in David Foster Wallace's language, he describes what I think is a Buddhist truth. But Buddhism... what I think is so wonderful about it is it offers us practices, practical ways of achieving that kind of freedom. And actually the freedom that Buddhism offers, the enlightened mind, goes well beyond, way, way beyond even what David Foster Wallace conceives. But what I want to say there is... actually, there is one thing that I don't quite agree with him in. That teaching, because he's saying that any type of spiritual thing is better. It's better to worship any type of spiritual being or truth than money and power and secular ideals. And sometimes I'm just not sure of that, because I think theistic religion as we've encountered it, can do a heck of a lot of harm, and does. I was reading this morning a story about in the Guardian about a village in India where the caste system, you know, in India, in rural India, the caste system is still very very powerful, and in this village they're all of a caste that would have been part of the ex-untouchable community, where people are treated worse than animals. And in this village, the tradition is that all young girls become sex workers. And the parents, and the family, and the whole community groom them in that. They train them in that. Because young girls are the source of income for the whole village, for the whole family. And... from an early age, they're groomed to do that. And by the time they reach their teens, the parents initiate them, you know, in becoming sex workers. It mentions one man, one family, who has five daughters, and he's refusing to do that with his daughters. He's refusing to allow them to do that. And he is being persecuted by the rest of the village In fact, the whole family is being persecuted by the rest of the village, because the belief that this is their lot, and somehow this is, it's not just a secular belief, it's what Hinduism tells them is their lot, because that is the caste and their work that that caste is assigned to. So if they don't do that, they're going against God. So they think that this is the righteous thing to do. So when you read things like that, because I was born in a Hindu culture, but my experience of Hinduism was benign. I mean, silly, but benign. But when you think of the horrors of when theistic traditions go wrong, I'm not sure I can completely agree with David Foster Wallace, yeah? All the time. But that's a minor, perhaps it's a minor quibble, but it's an important, I think it's an important one. But where he, I think, is spot on is saying that we all worship. In Buddhist language, in the traditional language, you could say that we all go for refuge to something. We all go for refuge to something. And I think he's spot on that if you worship the wrong things, it will eat you alive. And of course, it's not very obvious until you have worshipped for some years, and then you get trapped, and your world shrinks. And of course, we're familiar with what happens when that goes wrong, and you have all sorts of issues like addiction, for example, that can happen. Yeah, just by worshipping the wrong thing, it looks all right, and then it isn't. But that's an extreme. I think that many people who are not going to ever think of themselves as addicts or mentally unwell, from a Dharmic perspective, from a Buddhist perspective, they're still profoundly deluded and worshipping the things that are causing them real harm. And of course, it's not just that you just feel the harm yourself. We spread out our harm and harm the world around us. And then I also think he's completely right when he says that he talks about how the real freedom is learning to become less selfish. Yeah, that they're my words, but that's what he's saying. And that's not obvious. And as he says, the world of men and power and money hums along nicely, telling you that real freedom is to be found elsewhere. You know, the more money you have, the more freedom you have, apparently. That's what the world will tell you. But he's talking about a different freedom, and the Buddha was talking about a different freedom, and it's freedom of mind, and it's freedom from greed and hatred and delusion. And that's when you experience a consciousness that is totally free. And in that state of mind, whatever happens to you, you don't have to contract into pain, into suffering. So that's why it's freedom. That's why it's freedom, that nothing can take away the expansiveness, the beauty, the meaning, the joy, even, of that sort of freedom, even when things don't work out. Even when things don't work out. So that's what the Dharma's about. And the key to it is working on our self-centeredness, because it's our self-centeredness, which is very natural, by the way. I don't want us to get into guilt about it. That would be somehow not Buddhist either. It's natural to be self-centered. Somehow millennia of evolution have bred that into us. A traditional Buddhist way of thinking about it would be that we've lived countless lives where we've been deluded and think that we're the center of the universe. And that has such a force of momentum that we're born innately with an instinct to put ourselves at the center. That is innate in us. It's not something to feel guilt about. It's natural. But that's not all that we're capable of. We're also capable of great imaginative leaps of empathy and love and service. So Buddhism is saying, look, just move the energy from the me-oriented, self-oriented, to something beyond self, which is normally other people. And within that, you'll start to find a more expansive consciousness. You'll find a greater sense of fulfillment and meaning. Yeah, but it's not intuitively obvious. It might be intellectually all right to see. I mean, earlier on, before dinner, you know, I live in a community, there's 10 of us, 9 of us, I forget. I was a bit peckish. Supper was being cooked, but wasn't going to be ready for another hour or so. And there's this box of chocolates on the sideboard. And I think, okay. You know, and I opened the box, and it was a gift from somebody to the community, or to Matt, where are you? Yes. And there was one left in there. Watch that mental state map. There was just one left in there. And anyway, I looked around, and Matt was cooking, and there were other people busy doing things, and I just kind of just picked it up and popped it into my mouth. And it was gone before I could think about it, really. It was just instinct. It was instinct coupled with a vague sense that maybe this wasn't the most altruistic, karmic thing that I'll do today. But it goes quite deep, yeah. It goes quite deep. Although, it's funny, isn't it? But I mean, if my self-centeredness was limited to eating the last chocolate, I'd be happy, frankly. It goes much worse. It gets much worse than that. But I'm not going to go into all my various unskillful things. Today, by the way, today is my 20th order birthday. So 20 years ago today, in India, in a retreat centre outside Nagpur, I was ordained into what was then the Western Buddhist Order, has now become the Theravada Buddhist Order, by a man called Subhuti, who many of you know. And my day started with sending a WhatsApp message to Subhuti saying that I was thinking of him with love and appreciation and gratitude 20 years on. And he sent a WhatsApp message straight back, and he's in Bodh Gaya at the moment, leading a retreat. And we had a lovely little exchange. Well, I feel profoundly grateful that I found the Dharma, and that 20 years ago, I made a commitment to it. I made a commitment to practice as best I could. And I've got a long way to go. But to practice as best I could for the rest of my life, and not just this life, for lifetimes, hopefully. And I made that commitment without fully knowing what I was doing. And that's not my fault. It wasn't me particularly being inept or dim. You can't make a commitment to such a thing and fully know what you're doing. It is a commitment to the unknown. I had a sense that the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, were the highest values that I could, or they embodied, they encapsulated the highest values that I feel exist, that human beings are capable of aspiring to. I sort of intuited that from my first encounters with Buddhism. And certainly on my first retreat, I intuited that. And I was shaken up by that. I was uplifted on my first retreat, but I was also sobered, because I somehow intuited that this was the truth. And if it was the truth, I now had a choice. And if I followed that truth, my life would never be the same again, in ways that I couldn't imagine, but would be, I knew, challenging. And if I ignored the truth, which was a real choice as well, then I'd feel that I had betrayed myself and my aspirations, and I had a chance, and nothing else would ever fully satisfy me. I'd have this gnawing sense, as David Foster Wallace puts it, of having found and lost some infinite thing. Having found and lost some infinite thing. And at the time, I can remember thinking that that would be the most painful way of living, that I would feel, I'd have made a mess of my life, and that would have been tragic. It would have been tragic anyway, but it would have been particularly tragic, as it were, having found and then lost some infinite thing. If you never find it, you never find it. But if you do find it, you have that choice, and you have that challenge, really. And it's more than an 8-week challenge, believe me. It takes over if you let it. And I'm so very, very grateful that I did let it take me over. And yes, 20 years ago, as a young man with more hair, I made this commitment. It's also, today is the 42nd anniversary of my dad's death. So today is this 14th of January is a special day. And my dad's death when I was young set me on the path as well, because at that point I was old enough to realise that life as most adults around me were living it didn't make sense. As David Foster Wallace says, I saw then that money and power and wealth or whatever it was, status, weren't worth basing your life around. They weren't worth living for. They weren't real because you die. And then you die, and then what? And I wasn't old enough to fully articulate all of that and make sense of it, although maybe I did, I don't know. But it was enough to get me searching. Yeah. So the 14th of January, I felt, you know, my dad died when I was 11, and 22 years later, I was able to make a commitment. Thanks to the Sangha here, and thanks to Bhante Sangharakshita, my teacher, I was able to make a commitment. In retrospect, I was naive at that time. I thought that the spiritual life would be easy, or at least all joy and love and friendship. And it's had a lot of joy and love and friendship, but it hasn't always been easy, and it hasn't always been fun. And I still wrestle with the part of me that just wants to have that last chocolate and put the feet up. Given the choice, I wouldn't have been down here tonight. I'd have been probably watching something on Netflix. So I'm far from fully The Crown is what I'd have been watching. I'm far from fully integrated. Yeah, but nevertheless. That might sound a bit depressing, mightn't it? It might sound like, oh goodness, it hasn't worked for Jnana Bhatia. Yeah, that's not what I meant. That's not what I meant to leave you with. It has worked. It has worked for Jnana Bhatia. You should have seen me then, do you see what I mean? That's what I meant. Should have seen me 20 years ago. So it has worked, and there's more to do. That's what I'm trying to say. But the key thing that I'm trying to say in this talk is that commitment is needed. Now, you don't have to get ordained into the Tridwatna Buddhist order. That's not the only type. That's not the only way of making a commitment. But what I mean is committing to value, to meaning, that is more than some sort of false value of that the world sells us of a self-centered sort of value of what he talks about, money, power, sexual allure, what else does he talk about, whatever you can think of in terms of worldly values. I do think that it's to have a meaningful life, each of us has to find a way of committing to values that are transcendent, that take us beyond the bit of us that is just self-centered and self-oriented. Because if we live just from values that are self-oriented, our world will narrow. It will narrow, and we may think that we're achieving success, but our minds will become more and more dark and stuck and narrow and fearful. You only have to look at some very successful people, and you can sort of see that, can't you? I don't want to sort of name people, but I can think of people that probably we all know because they're famous, who are stuck, I think, in a narrow, self-centered hell, and yet they might think of themselves as the most successful people. Does that make sense? So commitment to to transcendent value is essential, and they don't teach us this in school, and the world around us tends not to emphasize it at all, but it is the way to have a fulfilled life. It's the way to become more than we otherwise would be. It's the way to start realizing our potential, or at least move in that direction. It's the way to grow up. Many, many people in the world never grow up. We kind of know that, don't we? We see them, we encounter them. We remain stuck in some sort of perpetual adolescence, even though our bodies get older. That way of living never, never fully works. Yeah. Now, you might be able to, if you're a particular temperament, you might be able to delude yourself that that is the only way to be, that that's all right, that transcendent values are a fantasy. You might be able to do that, and then, in a way, you know no better. Yeah. But if the Dharma has touched you, as it touched me when I went on retreat 25 whatever years ago, it's like part of you knows that you've found something that is pointing to something true. Yeah. And then, if you delude yourself, that'll be painful. That's horrible, a horrible thing to say to you, I know. But I do feel that when we encounter the Dharma, we encounter a challenge. Yeah. And there is a challenge of what are we going to do? What are we going to make of our lives? And as I say, I'm not saying becoming ordained in the Triratna Buddhist order is the only way to do it. I mean, I'm talking about the Dharma, I'm not talking about the Dharma as a set of values in this particular Buddhist movement. In a way, I'm not even talking about Buddhism. I'm talking about the Dharma as truth. The Dharma as truth. And the Dharma as truth is universal. It goes beyond any formulation or any manifestation in conditioned existence. This movement, this Sangha, is an attempt to channel the Dharma. Yeah? But it's only one. It might not be the right one for you. I don't know. But the point is, the Dharma as truth is saying that there is more to us, there is more to consciousness than we realize, and our self-centeredness is one of the veils that keeps us from seeing the truth. Our deluded views are another veil, and those veils don't have to be there. And when we realize, when we see things as they are, it will be like an acorn becoming an oak. It will be magical. It will be transformative. It will be like glimpsing the sun for the first time. You can never then go back into the cave and think that there isn't a sun. So that will take then commitment, because unfortunately what happens is you glimpse the truth, and unless you're an exceptional spiritual being, that one glimpse isn't enough. You glimpse it perhaps on a retreat, you glimpse something of the sun, and you see the truth, but you're not completely transformed. And that's why Buddhism says you have to have a path of gradual deepening dedication and commitment. That's why it's work, that's why it's unsexy, as David Foster Wallace says, it's petty little, or it's small, not petty, small little unsexy acts of unselfishness that are part of the path. Not losing your temper when you want to lose your temper, smiling at somebody when you don't feel friendly, etc., etc. Just those small acts of kindness, they start to build up. And of course, there's more. I'm not saying that that's all that there is to the path, otherwise, that wouldn't be so attractive. There's much more, there's magic involved as well. But it will all be based around transcending our self-clinging. It will all be based around that. The metta bhavana, the mindfulness of breathing, they're pointing to that. Buddhist ethics is pointing to that. And the perfection of wisdom is pointing to that. Because the perfection of wisdom, we'll come on to in a few weeks, the Heart Sutra. What that's saying is that the self-clinging that we have as such an instinct as part of being human, the self-clinging itself is a delusion. It's based on a delusion because self itself is a construct. There isn't a me, a real fixed separate me to hold on to in the first place. So we're clinging to a construct of our own delusion. And when we see that, the clinging drops away. So the Heart Sutra, the perfection of wisdom, is trying to point out the delusion. Buddhist ethics practices like the metta bhavana are trying to work on our self-clinging at a more emotional level, at a more volitional level. But that requires effort and it requires dedication and commitment. So in a way, that's all I want to say in this talk, really, is to see, to in a way, point out that you already have been challenged. It's not me that's challenging you. But if you've encountered the Dharma and responded to it, the challenge has been laid down for you. The challenge is there, it always was in a way. And I'm asking us to wake up to that and to see it squarely and take it seriously. And like David Foster Wallace says, can we do the difficult thing? Can we commit to the unglamorous thing of having values that are real and meaningful, but we won't necessarily be thanked for? We'll have to go against the grain of our culture, of our society, against maybe the grain of our friends, against the advice of family. We'll have to go against society at times to do the difficult thing, to do the challenging thing, to do the thing that says there is something much, much more than to us than we realize. So I want to finish with we're going to finish with a mantra, and we're going to finish with the Mantra Dosha mantra. But before that, I want to read you something from a book by Karen Armstrong. And it's this book that I was holding up earlier. And it's called The Case for God. You can sit comfortably. I'll tell us when we're going into the mantra. Don't worry. And this book, The Case for God, it's a wonderful book, actually. In it, she's Karen Armstrong, who's a very, very intelligent writer. I mean, she makes somebody like Richard Dawkins look crass and crude and unsophisticated, although I think, you know, he's a good man as well. Anyway, she does. She's arguing for theism, particularly monotheism, particularly Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. And she's saying that actually the notions of God in those three traditions have real profundity, although she does say that they've been misinterpreted by their own traditions. Literalized, misinterpreted, falsified, and damaged. So she's not naive. She's not a naive theist by any means. In the end, she starts talking of God in more mystical terms, in terms which felt to me more Buddhist than anything else. She's talking about transcendent experiences that I wouldn't call God. I'd call touch of seeing reality, seeing things as they really are. She's talking about that. And interestingly, you know, in a book that's devoted to those three monotheistic traditions and is very respectful of them, her last paragraph ends with the Buddha. Actually, she starts with the Buddha as well in her prologue, and in her last paragraph, she comes back to the Buddha. So that to me is moving. But she's also celebrating religion or religious people of all traditions. She's doing it, as I say, in an intelligent way. She doesn't mean religion as I was talking about in that Hindu caste-ridden village. That is religion as abomination, as cruelty, as horror. And unfortunately, many religions tend to send to that. And unfortunately, I have to say Buddhism in some Buddhist countries has descended to horror and hatred. And so even Buddhism, which holds non-violence as its central ethical tenet, can be misused by, I think, human selfishness and depravity sort of are unlimited, just as human potential for transcendence is unlimited. We're peculiar creatures, you know, at a crossroads of evolution, and we can go one way or the other. Most of us do neither. Most of us probably don't go into the depths of depravity that human beings are capable of, but we don't rise to the heights of our potential either. And Karen Armstrong is arguing that religion at its truest is about reaching our true potential. So I'll read this, and then we'll and then you can get into your meditation posture, and we'll sit quietly, and I'll start us in the chant of the Manjugosha mantra. I wanted to say one more thing before I read this, is that, well, yesterday, for the last 4 days, I was at Adishtana, which is where Bhante Sangharakshita lived for the last 5 years of his life. He died a couple of months ago at the age of 93, as you know, probably. Anyway, he lived there, and many of you have been on retreat there recently. And he is buried there. His body is buried there in... there's a mound, a burial mound, and a beautiful circular garden that's been constructed around it. And I was there for 4 days, and I spent some time circumambulating the burial mound and chanting the Manjugosha mantra, which the Manjugosha mantra for me is, because I've visualized that figure for a number of years, that the figure, the image, the Bodhisattva, Manjugosha, has become, in my mind, an image of the goal that I'm aspiring to, the transcendent goal that I'm aspiring to, and the mantra is a symbol for that. And I chanted it. Bhante had requested that we chant 5 particular mantras for him after his death, and the Manjugosha mantra was one of them. And I circumambulated his burial mound, his samadhi, for over an hour, and the sun was just setting. It was dusk, and it was beautiful. And the gardens, the field at Adishtana has all these oak trees that were silhouetted against the dusk. A very beautiful evening was sort of arising, and I spent a good deal of time just, well, either circumambulating or prostrating to this mound while chanting the Manjugosha mantra. And for me, what I was doing was rededicating my life to the values that I dedicated my life to 20 years ago. Because it's not a one-off. It's not a one-off. Actually, we need to do that every day. We need to keep this sense of dedication, commitment, resolve, whatever you want to call it, alive, because it's so easy, so, so easy to keep forgetting. I keep forgetting. And yes, the day before yesterday, what I was trying to do was both acknowledge my fallibility and my the lack of resolve that I have, and to rededicate myself in the presence of Bante, my teacher, to the Buddha Dharma and Sangha, to the values that he's revealed to me, because I feel very, very determined that I never want to lose this infinite thing that I've been given, that I've been shown. So yes, that was. I just wanted to bring in Bante and the need for us to find a way, however that expresses itself for you, to rededicate every day. So it's quite long, so I'll read it slowly. From almost the very beginning, men and women have repeatedly engaged in strenuous and committed religious activity. They evolved mythologies, rituals, and ethical disciplines that brought them intimations of holiness that seemed in some indescribable way to enhance and fulfill their humanity. The point of religion was to live intensely and richly here and now. Religious people are ambitious. They want lives overflowing with significance. They have always desired to integrate with their daily lives the moments of rapture and insight that came to them in dreams, in their contemplation of nature, and in their intercourse with one another and with the animal world. Instead of being embittered by the sorrow of life, they sought to retain their peace and serenity in the midst of their pain. They yearned for the courage to overcome their terror of mortality. Instead of being grasping and mean-spirited, they aspired to live generously, large-heartedly, and justly, and to inhabit every single part of their humanity. Instead of being a mere workaday cup, they wanted, as Confucius suggested, to transform themselves into a beautiful ritual vessel brimful of the sanctity that they were learning to see in their lives. They tried to honour the ineffable mystery they sensed in each human being and create societies that honoured the stranger, the alien, the poor, and the oppressed. Of course, they often failed. But overall, they found that the disciplines of religions helped them to do all this. Those who applied themselves most assiduously showed that it was possible for mortal men and women to live on a higher, divine or godlike plane, and thus wake up to their true selves. One day, a Brahmin priest came across the Buddha sitting in contemplation under a tree and was astonished by his serenity, stillness, and self-discipline. The impression of immense strength channeled creatively into an extraordinary peace reminded him of a great Tusker elephant. "Are you a god, sir?" the priest asked. "Are you an angel or a spirit?" "No," the Buddha replied. He explained that he had simply revealed a new potential in human nature. It was possible to live in this world of conflict and pain, at peace and in harmony with one's fellow creatures. There was no point in merely believing it. You would only discover its truth if you practiced his method, systematically cutting off egotism at the root. You would then live at the peak of your capacity, activate parts of the psyche that normally lie dormant, and become fully enlightened human beings. Remember me, the Buddha told the curious priest, as one who is awake.